Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
My name is Sarah Kim, and I'm from Austin, Texas. I'm a Cheeselandian because while life is great, cheese makes it better. Go to Cheeselandia.com to learn more, and if it's for you, sign up.
Hello, welcome to Japan Needs. I'm your host, Akiko Atema, a food writer and a director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Lucy Seligman, who is an author, life coach, and Zen coach. She has a cookbook called The Wonderful World of Osechi, Japanese New Year's Recipes. New Year is a big deal for Japanese people. It's the foremost, the biggest holiday in the year, which I would say is an equivalent of Thanksgiving and Christmas combined in terms of the cultural importance. And there are many kinds of special food involved in Japanese New Year celebration, and each has interesting cultural implications. So today, we'll discuss all about Japanese New Year's feast, along with Lucy's very intriguing life in Japan as a restaurant critic and writer. But before we start, Japan Needs is available on Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japan Needs. And please write to a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Now, let's start a conversation with Lucy Seligman. Hello, Lucy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
Yeah, I am very excited. So this is so timely. This is December 14th. So let's see. We have to know first who you are because you have a very interesting background. So where are you from and what did you eat when you grew up?
I love these questions. I grew up into a Hollywood family in Los Angeles. My dad was a TV and film producer. There were five kids and my mom and dad. To be completely honest, my mother was not much of a cook, which might explain why I love to cook so much. I remember lots of grilling that my father did. He loved to grill steaks and all sorts of things. I remember growing strawberries with him. I remember making kosher pickles with him. We were raised culturally Jewish, but not religious. So, you know, we would have lox and bagels every weekend, but we didn't go to temple or stuff like that. So kind of a real mix. I remember visiting my grandmother in New York, who literally all of the food came out of a can. So very different from how I eat now and how I've eaten as an adult.
Interesting. So when mother is a bad cook, it could be either way. It's a follow the path or go completely the opposite. So you took the opposite side.
I took the opposite. And actually from, I recently found scrapbooks from around 10 to 11 and 12, they were all filled with recipes. And I basically took over the cooking. So I've tried some of the recipes from that time and they still work, which I think is pretty funny.
So that sounds classic. So how did you get into Japanese culture?
Actually, it was a complete mistake, which, you know, it's so interesting to think about. I was supposed to go to Scandinavia when I was 15 to an island to study arts and crafts with an incredibly great group called the Experiment in International Living at that time out of Vermont. And literally like a month before I was supposed to go, and I'd spent months reading Scandinavian novels and studying about Scandinavia, they decided that anyone under the age of 16, it was too much of an insurance liability for kids to go to the program because it was an island. I, of course, was really surprised because since I grew up in LA and we had a swimming pool, I could swim before I could walk. But okay, I got it. And they said, we'll send you a list of all the other countries that are still open and you can go wherever you want. And I convinced my mother to let me go to Japan. I literally just looked down the list and pointed at Japan. We didn't know anyone there. Of course, I didn't speak Japanese at the time. And I told her, well, Mom, I can use chopsticks. It will be fine. And I was so clueless, and I've never been great at geography. I thought China and Japan were the same country. I mean, I was very naive. But the minute I stepped off the plane, I was in love with Japan. And that feeling has never stopped. The first trip was close to 3 months, and I studied Japanese in Hiroshima, and I stayed at Tokyo's Olympic Village, and I did a homestay with a family in a Japanese family in Okayama, and I just loved it. And I loved everything about it. And of course, I loved the food. And when I came back to America, I told everyone, I'm going back to Japan. It's going to be my major in college. No one believed me. And of course, eventually that's what happened.
Wow. That's pretty dramatic change. Well,
definitely.
Yeah, well, Scandinavian, I think the water there is too close, even for a good swimmer. But oh, that's amazing. So, yeah, and then you went back to Japan first as a college student and also as a resident for 13 years. So how did they happen?
So I eventually majored in Japanese and Japanese culture, and USC, which is where my degree is from in California, they were offering a junior year abroad at Waseda University. So once again, I convinced my mother to let me go, and I went and I lived with the Mitsui family. I was their 21st foreign daughter. This incredibly generous and wonderful family. And I lived there for a year. Of course, I loved it. My mother came to visit. She loved it. And eventually, a couple of years later, I married a Japanese national and I ended up living in both Tokyo and Nagoya. So if you think, if I add up all my time, I lived in Japan a total of a little bit over 13 years.
Wow. So it's impressive. Waseda University is really, long history, one of the greatest universities in Japan. And so the Mitsui family, is that Mitsui family or that Mitsui Zaibatsu?
Like, No. He was a camera shop owner. And it was very interesting. Mr. Mitsui actually had come over during the war to visit his uncle in America, and he was interned in an internment camp.
Wow.
And was not able to go back to Japan for a number of years. And even considering that incredibly horrible experience, he loved America and he loved Americans. And that's why this very modest family would host foreign students.
Wow.
And I was so lucky to be one of his daughters, American daughters. And even after my year there, we remained friends. He met when I got married, my then husband, and we stayed in touch until unfortunately he died. So very, very, very sweet family. And he actually would take me. He loved to have coffee in the morning, and we would get up early and talk about Japan and his life. And every Sunday we would go, and he would take me to a neighborhood restaurant for dinner so we could have more time together. It's just an incredible family.
Wow,
I was very
I'm so
lucky.
Glad. Yeah, it's just such a beautiful story. Okay, and then, so I heard while you were in Japan for about 13 years, you were a restaurant critic, food historian, and writer, and as the editor of a culinary newsletter on Japanese cuisine. So there are a lot there. So first of all, how do you become a restaurant critic, and what kind of restaurants did you review and for food?
Right. I had a restaurant review column with the Japan Times, and they were really great. They let me literally review Japanese and non-Japanese restaurants in the Tokyo area, and if I traveled outside of Tokyo, and I got to pick what I like to do. It's really interesting to me, even though that happened quite a few years ago. All the editors that I had when I lived in Japan were still all friends. Some are still in Japan. Some have gone back to their home countries, but we're still linked. And I also had a recipe food essay column for PHP Intersect for the Student Times, which was another paper of the Japan Times. I wrote a lot and started getting known as someone who loved Japanese food history and, you know, wrote essays about them and did recipes. And eventually I started my own newsletter, which was Gochisousama, which of course means thanks for the meal. And I did that along with all the other freelance writing that I did when I lived in Japan.
So, I mean, the Japan Times is the biggest English newspaper as far as I know. And but how do you become a restaurant critic at the Japan Times? You must have done something very spectacular.
I think, you know, I've been racking my brains to try to remember. I think what happened was I had been writing for other publications, and I literally just approached them and said, This is me. This is what I do. Here's some of my writing. And I would love to be a restaurant critic for you. And they let me do it. You know, I did a couple of columns and it was very well received. And I did it for a number of years. Of course, it was so much fun because what a great way to get to know the food world of Japan.
Right. So I'm sure you did something great. You were maybe not aware of how great that was. But, and you had your own cooking school called Lucy's Kitchen. So what kind of programs did you offer, and who were your students?
Well, because I speak Japanese, I was able to offer classes to native Japanese, regional, and it's very funny because I'm so interested in Japanese food history, I taught Japanese historical cuisine to Japanese, and which sounds kind of odd, but they were so interested. They might not have known about these recipes. But I also taught French. I taught Italian cooking. I taught Mexican cooking. I had my own school. I also taught at other schools. And of course, I had all my recipes. It was so much fun. And it was a great way, once again, to be part of Japan, spending time every week with different groups of women, many Japanese, but many expats or foreigners who are living in Japan, many of whom are my friends to this day. So I was very lucky. And even when I lived in Nagoya, I would go up to Tokyo once a month and teach there at other schools. So it was a lot of fun.
Right. Well, it's very impressive. Rather than only Japanese cooking, you were able to teach Italian, Mexican, other, you know, cuisine. So how did you study cooking, including Japanese?
So in terms of non-Japanese cooking, literally from my teens, I took cooking classes. And if I traveled to Europe, I would study cuisine. I was very lucky. I lived around the corner from the Cordon Bleu when I lived in Paris for 2 years. So you can imagine where I went every time I had a free moment. I studied cooking in Italy. I studied cooking in America, eventually getting certified by the Boston University's Culinary Arts Program. As for Japanese cooking, I took classes the whole time I lived in Japan, in Tokyo as well as in Nagoya. And because I lived, I guess you could say, more of a Japanese lifestyle, because my then husband was a Japanese national, I learned how to food shop. I learned how to cook Japanese dishes, especially osechi, from my then mother-in-law and sisters-in-laws. That was sort of the beginning. And I just continued to learn and study and read and cook on my own, actually, to this day.
Wow. Amazing. So, all right. So based on your knowledge, we're going to discuss osechi with you after breaks. So we'll take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll dive into the Japanese New Year's feast. So please stay with us.
My name is Sarah Kim, and I'm from Austin, Texas. I'm a Cheeselandian because while life is great, cheese makes it better. Wisconsin cheese has proven time and time again to be a delicious expression of craft, hard work, and tradition. As a Cheeselandian, I am able to share a Gouda experience with fellow cheese and food lovers nationwide, as well as connect with cheese producers and cheesemongers, taking my love of cheese to another level. I invite you to join Cheeselandia because during these difficult times, it has been even more important to take it easy and get cheesy. The Cheeselandia community and events have been the glue helping to keep us together and connected, and I would love it if you would join me. And let's face it, if you hear the word cheese and get a little hungry, then you've found a place you can call home. To find out more about Cheeselandia, go to cheeselandia.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Needs. I'm your host, Akio Katayama, and my guest today is Lucy Seligman, who is the author of the excellent cookbook, The Wonderful World of Osechi, Japanese New Year's Recipes. So let's talk about Japanese New Year's feast. First of all, what is the theme of your book, The Wonderful World of Osechi, Japanese New Year's Recipes, and why did you write it?
So even though I'm now based in the Bay Area and have been for many years, I have continued the tradition of making osechi every year with my daughter. And she loves Japanese cooking as much as I do. And, you know, it's not as fancy or as involved as it might be if we were in Japan, but we have osechi favorites and we continue to celebrate Oshogatsu, Japanese New Year, every year with osechi. When I thought about what would I like to write about as a cookbook, because I also have Thanks for the Meal, which is my Japanese food blog right now, I realized, of course, the first book I'll write would be on osechi. And it's really filled with not only kind of a explanation of what are the traditional osechi foods and with recipes, but also what are some of my favorites. And I really, really love that everything in osechi has a symbol or symbolizes something. And I love the concept of, you know, you celebrate osechi, you celebrate Japanese New Year. It's kind of a year-end ritual. And it's an annual tradition that families do. And it doesn't change. You know, it may, of course, dishes may change a little bit. Every household has their favorites. But I love the tradition of you get all your shopping done. You've planned the menu. Most of the cooking is done in advance because it's the dishes are served cold. And the actual holiday, which is January 1st to January 3rd, is really an enjoyable and relaxed time with your family, enjoying good food, good drink. You may have visits from other family members, and it's just sort of a way to ring out the old year and ring in the new year. And I can't think of a more important tradition to do that than this year, to be honest.
Right. 100%. Yeah, we in Japan, we don't have any major event, like national event, because, you know, majority of Japanese people are not Christians or Jewish, or, you know, the Halloween's kind of commercial, Valentine's Day.
So, right.
Yeah, everybody's focus actually is really in New Year, and also it has to be sacred. So, yeah, it's a big deal. So let's talk about, I mean, the 3 days, as you said, the 1st to the 3rd of January is the focus. But before that, you said it's a lot of things. That there are many rituals. So for listeners who are not familiar with the Japanese New Year, could you tell us the classic rituals from, you know, before the New Year to through the January 3rd?
Right. So one thing that people traditionally do is on New Year's Eve, December 31st, they eat toshikoshi soba. And toshikoshi soba is, I call it basically, traditionally you have it at midnight on New Year's Eve into the first, and it is years passing soba. It's good luck soba for the coming year. Very, depending on where you are, you may have different ingredients in it. Because I first ate toshikoshi soba in Tokyo, my toshikoshi soba is quite simple, with chicken and Japanese leeks, negi, in a dashi soyu base. And it again, it's kind of setting you up for the end of 1 year, moving into the next year. And, you know, what you can do is you can even make reservations in Japan to buy freshly made soba to cook up at home. When I lived in Japan, I actually tried making it myself. It was the one and only time I did it, using fresh buckwheat flour. And I got many nods of approval from my Japanese family, even though without this special chef's knife used by soba cutters, they were a trifle thick, to be honest. But it's a nice tradition. And of course, this year I'll be making it here in the Bay Area. Then what else do you do? From the first to the third, the other tradition that you would do is you would visit on the 31st, you would visit a shrine or temple, or into the first or second or third, depending on where you live and what's happening. And this custom is called Hatsumode, and it's where you pray for good health and safety and good fortune for the coming year. And this period of January 1st to the 3rd, businesses are shut down. It is a tradition. I'm not quite sure about what's going to happen this year. It's a tradition that you travel back to your hometown or wherever your parents are, and you spend that period with your family. There's many other traditions of that period, but that's sort of the beginning until we get to osechi and Japanese New Year's dishes.
Right. So let's just quickly going back to toshikoshi soba. So those toshikoshi means passing the year. So
yes,
it's important eating, you know, the New Year's Eve is ideally at the midnight.
Yes.
Means a smooth transition to 1 year to the next.
Right.
And it's part of, you know, the hope that next day is going to be nice and happy. And this soba is long. That means a long life.
Long life, right.
That's another implication of happiness and positive thing to happen in the new year. And so you said that it's, you know, the Hatsumode, it's like going to a temple or shrine and to pray for the good year. That in my case, we would eat toshikoshi soba at midnight and go to bed, and then wake up like 5 o'clock in the morning, very first thing in the morning, go to a shrine, pray, go back to sleep, and then wake up like 10 o'clock and then start eating osechi. So that was our ritual, but there's so many variations.
There are many variations. And, you know, there's some people do watch the sunrise on New Year's Day, sometimes on the top of a mountain like Mount Fuji. You know, I don't like the cold. I couldn't imagine doing that. But one thing that I really, really miss here in the Bay Area, it used to be I could hear it on TV occasionally. They don't seem to offer it anymore, is Omisoka. And at the stroke of midnight, all the Buddhist temples in Japan, 108 bells are rung. And this kind of is a, you could call it a sort of purification and getting ready for the new year, getting rid of anything that happened in the old year and bringing in the new. And I don't know why I love those bells. It's, again, another tradition of separating the old to the new.
Mm, right. So they say there are 108 some negative feelings, desires, exactly. Worries, and sadness. Unless by ringing the bell, you just get rid of it one by one.
Right.
So as you eat the toshikoshi soba, you listen to the temple bells, and then
right.
You're getting ready gradually for the great year to come. So, yeah, it's not just eating soba. And it's the beginning of the sacred moment of the year.
Right. Right. And it's so, what a wonderful symbolic, but actually something that you do to sort of establish getting rid of releasing the old and bringing in the new. I just love the whole concept.
Right. Yeah. As opposed to like when I look up, you know, New Year's Eve in this country, in America, mm-hmm. How do you get rid of hangover on the first day of the year? Like, that's the complete opposite. You don't
exactly.
Want to start the-
You know, I never, even before I ever went to Japan, I never liked American New Year's Eves. And I never understood the whole point, you know, and I think that's why my first experience of osechi and oshogatsu and toshikoshi soba made such an impact to me. And it just felt more natural. It meant more to me. And it's why I've continued to do it and why it's something my daughter expects every year as well. You know, it's our celebration.
Right. Yeah, I mean, being in America, I'm okay with having nice champagne and celebrate with friends.
me too.
Yeah, but being in Japan, there's some different feeling that you get about New Year. Like it starts, I think, you know, like given the all companies stop working simultaneously on the 29th, I think, and then everybody starts cleaning the house. And I mean, literally, whole house is clean just for the New Year.
Yes. Right.
And so it's not just 3 days. Everything's about cleansing your mind and spirit, and everybody's
right.
Get to reset. So that's Japanese New Year.
And I love that concept of reset. And you're right. You know, I remember God spending days cleaning the house, and I still do that here. You know, it's so funny you said that. I was looking at my calendar. When will we start cleaning the house? I already set the date that we'll go shopping for osechi ingredients. And sort of the last, you know, 4 or 5 days of the year is taken up with preparing for our celebration.
Right. Okay, so so people eat the osechi, like you said, during the first 3 days of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard that the history of eating osechi goes back to the Heian period, which was from 8th to 12th century, somewhere between them. So what exactly is osechi and why is it important to Japanese people?
So if you can imagine, osechi has a very special look. And if you can if you don't know what it looks like, if you imagine very ornate lacquered boxes stacked on top of each other, the boxes are called jubako, and they're absolutely beautiful. And each tier, there's usually four tiers, has specific foods that you eat. I think, again, what I love about osechi is, you know, each food has a meaning and has a placement. For example, and all the dishes in these jubako are cold, so they're prepared in advance. In the old days, they were very, very heavily sugared. It was a way to preserve the dishes since they were served on the first and then refilled and continued to be served the first, second, and third of January. Of course, now these days people, you know, we have refrigeration, we can control the temperature. We don't use as much sugar as in those days, but I love that each tier means something. And if you'd like me to explain a little bit about each tier, I'd be happy to.
Okay. So yeah, let's just, I think there's a theme of each tier, right? So yeah, right. Please.
Right. So the first tier, the top tier, Ichinoju, has the most festive foods. And it has things like kamaboko, which is colorful red and white steamed rice cakes. And it's eaten with wasabi and soy sauce.
And fish cakes, right? Fish cakes, right.
Yeah. And it's a remembering that red and white in Japan are good luck colors. So a lot of the colors of osechi follows that. Also, other dishes that you might find in the first tier are kobumaki and dried herring and tazukare, which is dried sardines. Again, we don't have time to go into each one, but always meaning something. Kuromame, which is sweet black beans. They represent good health. So not only are they a symbol of health, but it's also kind of the associate idea that if you're in good health, you can work hard in the year to come. Those are some of the dishes.
Right. Yeah. So mame is beans, but the mame means, kind of industrial. So right. That means if you eat kuromame, you become an industrious person. You work right. hard and stay healthy. And it's interesting. So this, all right, so that's the first tier. But by the way, this lacquer box, like, you know, the five, the four layers of lacquer boxes on top of each other. It's usually shiny and saved for that occasion. And it's stored it's carefully.
Exactly. Yeah. It's kept tucked away. It's only used for osechi. I have some, but they're not the really high-end one, which are very, very pricey. They're so beautiful and ornate. If you Google it, jubako, you'll see examples of them. And, you know, another thing is the chopsticks that you use for osechi for Japanese New Year are new. And they're used only for this period. So it's kind of like everything is new and special. The second tier, Ninoju, has the grilled foods. And it could be yellowtail or chicken teriyaki. It's large salted grilled prawns served in their shells. And, once again, all prepared in advance, but served, you know, on the first day and through the second and third. The third tier, Sannoju, is this whole tier contains vegetables individually boiled in a sweetened dashi. And it's called nishime. And it's actually one of my favorite dishes. And they're beautifully cut vegetables, things like carrots and reconstituted shiitake mushrooms and burdock root, lotus root, fresh water chestnuts, a whole combination of flavors, beautifully presented. And then the last tier, the fourth tier, Yonoju, has pickled dishes like namasu, which is a very colorful salad of shredded carrots and daikon radish. And, you know, other foods like marinated turnips in a sweetened vinegar. And sometimes a punctatus, which is like a mackerel marinated in a tart vinegar sauce. So when you think about it, if you think of all four of the tiers, your taste buds are exploding with all sorts of different flavors. That's not the whole meal, but that's kind of the basic of it.
Right. Yeah. So like you said, there are many implications in each tier. Like, for example, there is a shrimp, like whole shrimp. Mm-hmm. And shrimp looks like old man, old woman. So because the back is kind of like, you know, and not straight. So that means that you live long. And that's,
exactly.
Yeah. And, you know, komumaki is kombu. And the kobu sounds similar to yorokobu, which is joy. So
right.
You're going to have a lot of joy in the new year. So it's just like so many happy things. And too bad we can only have it once a year. But that's why I think
exactly.
It's precious.
For example, kazunoko, which is salted herring roe and eggs, it's a very prized and sort of pricey delicacy, but it symbolizes a prosperous and large family. So it's symbolizing fertility. Kazu meaning number because of all the little herring roes, and ko meaning children. So once again, you have health, you have fertility, you have industriousness, you know, you have good luck and for the new year. I love that every dish means something.
Right. And not just that, it's colorful and also
yes.
highly nutritious and balanced. Like the kazunoko, for example, that cured herring roe, that has a lot of good stuff for our body. And also
right.
it's crunchy and it's so addictive. So I would just fight for it. I'm the person straight going to kazunoko because it's so
I love
good.
It too. Yeah. And I, you know, the other dishes that sort of one other dish that isn't in this, mainly because it's so large and it's kind of like the centerpiece, is yakisakana. And usually it's a whole salted sea bream Thai fish that's grilled and it's presented in the centerpiece of the dining table. And it's garnished with pine needle branches and it's, you know, it's delicious served cold. And then the next day, you could even pour lots of sake over it and steam it and continue to eat it. So there's another dish I'm sure you'll ask
oh,
me
Oh, hold on,
there.
Hold on. So the Thai is a sea bream, and the
yes.
Thai has a pun with meditai. Meditai is festive. So that's
right.
another meaning. So and
yeah,
it's a,
exactly.
Right. And the Thai is red, which is a happy color.
Happy
so
color.
Much good luck.
right. You know, and the whole thing like namasu, which I mentioned, the vinegared salad, you know, again, the red and white colors associated with happiness and celebration in Japan. I just like that the whole concept of osechi and the way it's served, it's so intentional, you know, and all the symbolic meanings are positive meanings for us. Again, releasing the old and bringing in the new.
Right. Well, one dish I really want to discuss because it's in your book too, that's kintan, and it's delicious.
Yes.
So what is kintan and why
right.
should you eat it in the new year?
Right. So kuri kintan is a mashed sweet potato puree with candied chestnuts. Now, you don't have to put the chestnuts in, but it does kind of add a nice flavor and crunch. And in the old days, if you served kuri kintan, in the translation was chestnut gold mash, which I love that. And again, it can be suffocatingly sweet, but you can adjust the sugar of it. And again, it's symbolizing wealth and economic prosperity. If you think about it, the dish is yellow in color, which you associate with gold. And by eating Kuri Kintone, it's bringing in and allowing in financial prosperity for the year to come. You know, you usually end up making too much. And as just as an aside, I have spread it on jam, on toast, like jam, after the New Year's is over. It's delicious. And I have even served it at Thanksgiving, and it was a big hit. So, you know, you can tweak it a little bit and not just have it during Japanese New Year's.
Right. Well, in the box, the, you know, New Year's box, that was the item which always sold out because me and my brother was like fighting, like literally, who's going to get it first. Yeah, and it's what I think it's really, you can preserve it in a jar, you know, right. Just, it's really, really good. So the point is that, you know, Japanese New Year, even if it's pre-prepared, it's high-end delicacies. All yes. over in the four boxes. So, and so listeners, you can find that in Lucy's book. But I just want to ask you, it's really not in the box, but there is a special item that's called ozoni. So what is ozoni?
So one of the ideas of Japanese New Year's is that the, you know, historically or traditionally, the Japanese housewife would not spend her time in the kitchen, which means that she wouldn't make rice. So as an alternative for Japanese New Year, people would eat mochi, which is fresh rice cakes. And, you know, I've always loved mochi, and I'm very lucky that here in the Bay Area, we can buy fresh or you can buy dried. And you toast them. So it's, you know, pounded rice cakes, usually in a square or a circle. You toast them. And ozoni is the regional soup that can even differ from house to house, that it is literally the only hot dish that is served during osechi. And it is sort of the conclusion of the meal. And mochi, of course, the fresh mochi, if you're lucky to get it, is served in many different ways throughout this period. We love mochi. And I always want to try, or I always suggest to my daughter, a different ozoni to make. But we always seem to come back to one that is from a specialty of Hokkaido, because we both love salmon and we love salmon roe. So that's probably the one I'm going to make this year as well. But it's so much fun to kind of travel around, you know, culinarily travel around Japan each year and making a different ozoni.
Right. So even our listeners can make, you know, their own, right? So basically, it's usually a beautiful laka ball, again, for right. the new year. And then
and
put a
nice...
And a
deeper one than your typical soup bowl.
Right. And you yeah. feel special, how like laka feels good in the hand. And inside there's, you know, your own stock, like dashi.
Right. Right.
To your liking. And you can just put the mochi and anything else you can. So... That's a very creative project, and you can really feel good about having it swarming and cleansing and delicious.
And it's delicious, right. And, you know, it has vegetables and it might have fish, it might have chicken, and sometimes it might have miso. You know, there's a Kyoto-style ozoni I make that uses white miso. So, you know, it's fun to try different types.
Right. So it's ozoni. It's O-Z-O-N-I, ozoni. Right. So, by the way, before you eat the New Year's feast, you sip otoso. So
yes.
What is it? That's important.
Yes. Yes, yes. So otoso is a spiced, cold, medicinal kind of flavored sake that you drink during the New Year's period. And again, if you think of the kanji or the characters, otoso means, the first kanji means evil spirits, and the second kanji means to defeat. So once again, by drinking otoso and toasting everybody at the table, you're releasing or flushing away any bad luck or misfortune from the previous year and welcoming in the new. It is an acquired taste, but you only drink it as your toast, and then you go for the rest of the meal, and you know, the rest of those days you're drinking regular sake. I like it, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, it's like a very herbaceous and somewhat medicinal, but there usually get 5 to 10 different ingredients, including, right, you know, the fruit of sancho, you know, the orange peel and the cinnamon and the things. And then, so here's the thing. I like totoso because it has to be drunk first.
Right.
By the way, youngest person in the family, and I was the youngest in the family. That was the first time in my life to be able to do first in the family. So. Yeah. So.
And it's aromatic, then, and it, you know, yeah, it's a kind of a nice way to, once again, to begin New Year's Day.
Right. And the amount of alcohol can be very slight. Or right, some people can add more, a lot of sake. So, and I think that the herbs, you can buy it in a small bag, like $2 or something at the supermarket.
Right.
And then you can just add sake or, you know, the mirin.
Mirin, and, right. And you let it steep for a little while.
Right.
It's kind of a fun way, something new to try.
And good for your health.
Yes, definitely.
Right. So, yeah, there's so many other things we can discuss, but I'm so glad that you picked this right time and we can just discuss right before the new year so our listeners can prepare their own new year reset
right,
food. So that's great. And so your book, The Wonderful World of Osechi, Japanese New Year's Recipes, contains plenty of cultural background of Japanese cuisine and simple and easy recipes. So where is it available?
Amazon.
Okay.
I have a paperback and an ebook version. And you can, you know, even if you just type in Osechi, my book pops up first.
Great. Yeah, and a little pictures and the cultural background. I really enjoyed reading it. So, yeah, thank you for writing
that.
Okay. And, well, you have, like briefly mentioned, you have a great website about Japanese food. So, thanksforthemeal.net. So, what is it about?
So, I started Thanks for the Meal about 3 years ago. And it is my favorite Japanese recipes, and it's not just osechi, it's everything. And I have guest bloggers at two sometimes because it's kind of fun to see other people's views. And it's just mini food essays and original recipes. And if you go to thanksforthemeal.net and you sign up, you get a collection of traditional Japanese salad dressings as a gift from me to you.
Great. Yeah, I really feel that you love Japan. It's all from your, what you write about, and you are such a cheerleader of Japanese culture, so I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. That's so sweet. You know, Japan, I've always considered since I went at 15, it is my second home. You know, at the moment, it's my second home in my heart because I don't live there, but it will always be my second home.
Right. Okay. So thank you so much for joining us today, Lucy. And I wish you a happy New Year, Japanese New Year.
Akimashite omedetou gozaimasu.
Omedetou gozaimasu. All right, so listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanese@heritageradionetwork.org or kikogatema.com. Japanese is a weekly program and always available at theheritageradionetwork.org as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Our engineer is Amanda Wong, And we'll take a break for the next couple of weeks. So I will see you in the new year. And thank you all for listening. Happy holidays, everyone. Japan Needs is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a non-profit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.